Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. To all beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, and a whole lot of corporate restructuring is what's going on. McDonald's is trying to get back in the game. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, the 4th of May. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Here is today's corporate speak phrase of the day. It comes to us from Steve Easterbrook. He's the CEO of McDonald's, who launched a big, and it cannot go unsaid, long-awaited turnaround plan this morning. Easterbrook said he wants to turn the Golden Arches into a, and this is a quote, modern, progressive burger and breakfast restaurant. Fair enough. In the event, though, there wasn't a whole lot of talk about Big Macs and Egg McMuffins, more about restructuring, refranchising, and returning cash to shareholders. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner gets us going.
If investors were hoping McDonald's would announce a sweeping new menu of hipper, healthier fast food, no such luck. CEO Steve Easterbrook was more about upping the share of franchised restaurants, cuts down corporate overhead, and streamlining the organization.
What that gives us is an opportunity to put our greatest talent in the most influential positions. How can we get the best teams in our major markets? How can we get the best thinkers running those markets?
Which is all fine and good, says Tim Calkins at Northwestern's Kellogg School.
But I think the real reason they went with this announcement today is that they have to announce something, but it's not clear what the real fix is going to be.
That's partly because McDonald's is a polarizing brand, says Calkins. For some, it's an easy, cheap meal with the kids. For others, well, does supersize may ring a bell? Columbia Business School's Michelle Greenwald believes the chain's core audience is shrinking.
More and more people are aware of the need to eat healthy. And if they're going to indulge in things that are caloric, they want something that's really super delicious.
That brings to mind McD's famous fries, but no time to argue. Analyst Nicole Miller-Reagan at Piper Jaffray insists the McDonald's fix isn't catering to younger foodies with guacamole burgers or kale salads.
They have the best demographics. They cut across gender, income, geographies, ethnicity. Why would you give that up to go after a millennial?
Reagan says it's more important McDonald's stay true to its core menu and perhaps new ways to order and deliver it. After all, it's supposed to be fast food. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
554, ladies and gentlemen, 554 days left until Election Day. About a year and a half, in other words, which means we are right now smack dab in the middle of official presidential campaign announcement season. Neurosurgeon Ben Carson announced today, as did Carly Fiorina. The former CEO of Hewlett-Packard said this morning she's the best person for the job because she understands, these are her words, how the economy actually works. One might call that the CEO advantage. One might also call it the CEO disadvantage. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn is on it.
To see the downside of being a CEO candidate, look no further than CarlyFiorina.org. It reads, Carly Fiorina failed to register this domain, so I'm using it to tell you how many people she laid off at Hewlett-Packard. And then 30,000 frowny emoticons.
Oh, that's an eye catcher.
George Anders wrote the book Perfect Enough, Carly Fiorina and the Reinvention of Hewlett-Packard. And he says 30,000 layoffs is in the ballpark.
So the math gets a little complicated, but you're going to end up with a number in the low tens of thousands.
He says most of them were the product of a big merger with Compaq, which she showed great willpower in pursuing. And Fiorina is saying she'd stand by her record at HP. But those specific qualities of leadership will not get scrutinized as much as this question of jobs, according to Wharton professor Mike Youseem. Just look at Mitt Romney and his record at private equity firm Bain Capital.
Whether Bain Capital created more jobs than it took away was one of the great debating issues. And that obviously is going to be debated in the case of Carly Fiorina. Net, was she a job creator?
Nick Carnes at Duke University has studied CEO politicians at every level of elected office.
Whether I'm talking about Congress or a state legislature or a city council, the more politicians you have who are CEOs, the more conservative economic policy you get.
But regardless of how they lean, the question of whether CEOs are better or worse at actually governing, that's something Carnes says we just don't have the research on. I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
It's been a tough couple of weeks for social media companies share price-wise, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Yelp, to name just the most conspicuous examples. Bad news, or even just not so great news, can send social media companies on wild rides. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has more on that from New York.
When LinkedIn told investors the year ahead wasn't looking as rosy as previously thought, yikes, its stock dropped 20% in a morning. Twitter saw a similar plunge when it surprised the markets with weak earnings. So if social media stocks seem a little volatile,
our belief is they should be.
Rick Sommer is an equity strategist at Morningstar. He says it's not so much that these are social media companies. It's that they're growing super fast and their business models are still uncertain.
We don't have a great deal of history in understanding how you and I as users will interact with those advertising products and how advertisers will value that degree of advertising.
So the stock price of many social media companies isn't based on how much they make today, but what investors believe they one day will. Shyam Patil with Wedbush Securities says if suddenly a company's not growing as fast as everyone thought,
it's kind of like compounding, right? You know, if you're trying to figure out what $1,000 today is going to be worth in 30 years, a 2% change in the growth rate is going to have a significant impact.
That's not unique to social media companies, and it doesn't mean they're falling out of favor, says Brian Weiser, an analyst with Pivotal Research.
When you look at the value of these stocks, they're significant before and significant after. We can argue about whether or not the market overreacts. Absolutely.
But Weiser says a bouncy stock price doesn't change the inherent value of these companies, just what Wall Street thinks that value is. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, the major indices inched up a hair. McDonald's not so much, down 1.7%. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We did a story back in November about Denton, Texas, about how a town in the middle of oil and gas country had banned fracking. The smart money was on some kind of pushback from the oil and gas industry, and indeed it has come. Today, the Texas legislature banned fracking bans. Similar proposals are working their way through the process in other states as well. Marketplace's Scott Tong is back on the story for us. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Kai.
All right, Texas has passed its bill in the legislature. It's going to the governor. What would it do?
Well, you mentioned the governor. Everyone expects the governor to sign it. Mm-hmm. And the bill would provide what's called state preemption. And that is state law here would trump anything that local jurisdictions, cities, or towns pass, including, you mentioned Denton, Texas, and they passed a ban on that. Well, this would undercut that. Now, next door in Oklahoma, a similar bill has also passed one chamber, and the sponsor there said he wants to, quote, get ahead of what we're seeing in other states. So this is happening not just in Austin.
Are they connected, though, Oklahoma? And I mean, there are other states as well.
Well, there's a group that connects state lawmakers, mostly on the right, with business, and it's a group called ALEC. That's the acronym. And a person at ALEC said, yes, they have been communicating with officials in various states on this issue, and he said what others have told me, and that is the key argument here is economic interest, that especially in these historically oil and gas states, that's the preeminent interest, Kai.
What happens then if these bills get passed, or when they get passed?
Well, what happens underground, as we said, is governed by the states, and then above ground, a lot of places have rules on, say, how far a well can be from a house or a school. And in the state of Texas, the bill language says they have to be commercially reasonable. So the burden is on the local jurisdiction to do something that is reasonable to the economic interest. So, you know, it looks like it's something that the industry certainly likes.
Right. Is there a bigger picture here? Is there a federal picture on this? I mean, we've been talking states.
A lot of fight in a lot of states. The thing to remember is that the federal government does regulate drinking water, but for a decade now, these fracking wells have been exempt from EPA oversight.
Scott Tong from the Sustainability Desk. We got him in Washington. Thank you, Scott.
Okay, you're welcome.
Something like 2 million high school students around the country are going to start taking advanced placement exams this week. The kinds of tougher, more challenging courses that research shows can help kids get into and succeed in college. Adrian Hill had the first part of our series on AP courses last week about the ways some high schools are pushing to get more kids, especially minority and low-income students, into those classes. Today, after some time spent filing on the Baltimore News of last week, Marketplace's Amy Scott picks up from the education desk at WIPR with her look at what happens after those courses are expanded. Here's Amy.
Luis Romero has taken so many AP courses, he can barely remember them all.
Oh, okay. AP Computer Science, Human Geography, U.S. Government, World History.
He sounds like a typical teenager in a typical high-achieving high school. But not that long ago, Luis would have stood out at North County High in Glen Burnie, Maryland. It's a diverse school in a working-class suburb of Baltimore.
When I first came, there was a sense of just low expectations.
Julie Karras is the principal at North County. She says 5 years ago, only 10% of the school's 2,000 students took any AP classes. Less than a quarter of seniors planned to go to a four-year college.
A lot of kids not only didn't believe it was possible, but it didn't even occur to them that that was something they might do.
North County wanted to build a college-going culture, so the school added AP courses, got rid of all the requirements to get in, and pushed every kid to take at least one.
We decided to open the gates, basically, and then it just became something that we do here. When you come to North County, you take an AP class.
In 5 years, the number of AP students tripled from around 200 to about 600. That means more students in classes like AP English, where these juniors are wrestling with concepts like polysyndeton and metonymy over my head.
Who thinks they have rhetorical questions?
Each student has to identify the rhetorical strategy in a passage from literature or popular music.
What's love got to do with it? What's love but a secondhand emotion?
Yes, those are lyrics from a Tina Turner song.
Why would Tina Turner not expect an answer?
Because she's singing.
Student Tyler Baynard may not have considered taking a class this challenging before the shift.
I didn't even know what AP was. The middle school I went to, I feel like it didn't really prepare me for high school, so AP classes was kind of a shock.
The transition was kind of a shock for North County, too. Jennifer Mermod teaches AP English.
The original intent was like, we're going to help more kids. This is going to be awesome. Bring us more kids. And it did, but then there were those kids that we thought, wow, this may not have been the best push for them.
And so some gatekeeping came back. Mermod says kids who might do better in a regular honors level class are encouraged to stay there and get a higher grade.
I want them to get into college if that's the point of the program. So I really don't want a kid that's going to not at least get a C.
The school also added more tutoring and expanded an AP support program to teach kids note-taking and study skills. Teachers also had to make adjustments, since they're not just getting the brightest and most motivated students anymore. Mermod says to keep classes challenging for those kids.
Sometimes you spread them up so they can serve as leaders. Other times you cohort them together so they can have their higher level. You came prepared. You deserve to be rewarded with a better discussion.
But as more high schools push less prepared kids into AP, there's a risk the whole class can suffer. Denise Pope is co-founder of Challenge Success, a project at Stanford University.
You may have to water it down so much that it's not going to really be considered a college-level course.
That was the original purpose of AP courses, to give talented students a chance to earn college credit or advanced placement by doing college-level work while still in high school. Today, in many schools, the thinking goes more like this.
Oh, well, AP is rigor. Therefore, AP is the solution to having kids prepared for college.
Kristen Klopfenstein directs the University of Northern Colorado's Education Innovation Institute. She says adding AP classes can also boost a school's standing, but she questions the value of pushing kids into those classes if they aren't likely to pass the official AP exams.
The research is pretty clear that that confers no advantage to them in terms of their post-secondary enrollment and outcomes.
At North County High, more than two-thirds of students generally don't pass the exams. That means no college credit. Principal Julie Karras says they're working on that, but she says even without the college credit, students learn a lot about reading challenging texts, writing, and thinking.
They're still learning those skills that are pushing them forward.
Junior Neve Archuleta didn't pass her first AP test last year in government, but she says taking the class changed how she thinks about herself and her future. She's taking two more this year.
Before AP, I thought I was definitely like too average for college, but I think now that they see that I've challenged myself, that they're going to be more impressed.
And she says even if she has to take government all over again in college, she'll be a lot more prepared. In Glen Burnie, Maryland, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
You can check out the first part of our AP Advanced Placement exam coverage from Adrian Hill. It's at our website. And while you're there, you can also find out Advanced Placement participation rates by race at public high schools all across the country. It's at marketplace.org. Coming up, junk food for all my friends.
When Twinkie went out of business, it was national news. People were selling Twinkies and cupcakes on eBay for $10,000 a box.
Totally worth it, too, right? Now, first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 46 points today, about 0.25%, closed at 18,070. The NASDAQ gained 11 points, 0.2%, 5,016. The S&P 500 up 6 points, 0.3%. 2114. Hey, listen, were you smart enough to buy Cisco Systems right after the dot-com bust? Congratulations, Cisco is nearly 50% higher today, all these years later. Dumb enough to buy a year before the bust? Yeah, half your investment is still gone. John Chambers saw a boom and bust as CEO of Cisco for two whole decades, but today he announced he's retiring. Cisco up 0.1% today. Lower prices for pork and chicken mean higher profits for Tyson Foods last quarter. Tyson up 1.5% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.14%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade for March. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? I don't know, but it's National Egg Month. And she won a Grammy and an Oscar for the song Skyfall. Adele turns 27. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Surprising absolutely nobody, the new Marvel movie, Avengers Age of Ultron, topped the U.S. box office this weekend, almost $188 million. That's the second biggest opening weekend for a movie ever after the first Avengers movie back in 2012. Ticket receipts, though, are just the beginning for Avengers Incorporated, Ezra Morris reports.
Sales of Avengers merchandise leapt from $325 million in 2013 to over a billion in 2014. There's everything from gamma-ray blasted Greek yogurt from Chobani to the Hulk's cologne from Jad's International that smells like sandalwood, dry musk, and warm cedar. But who's buying all of this stuff? I went to the Arclight Theater in Hollywood on opening weekend to ask people if they had anything else Avengers-related besides their movie ticket.
Do I?
T-shirts, I have
dishes and mugs and stuff like that.
I'm wearing Avengers underwear. Does that count?
I've got an Iron Man helmet.
I have, at least, actively been looking for a really cool Avengers bedsheet.
Well, we're married, so we kind of own all that stuff together, yeah.
All of those collaborations with brands like Under Armour and Forever 21 really add up. And the push is worldwide. Get this, Age of Ultron is the most marketed movie ever in India. So I asked Ira Kalb.
Yes, Ira Kalb, assistant professor of clinical marketing at the Marshall School of Business at USC.
Why has the Avengers brand been so successful in making the jump to mainstream culture?
Well, what a brand has to do is they have to strike a chord in the brain of the buyers that they're targeting. And Marvel characters already have that. And what they're doing is they're tapping into that relationship.
So are we seeing nostalgia at play here?
There's a nostalgia involved. And, of course, there's new people being brought into the brand. if younger people come and see the movies that maybe their parents or their grandparents knew about the characters, then that's definitely going to bring in more and more people into the brand. And then, of course, the Marvel characters are based on heroes usually, and everyone's looking for heroes to help us out of all the bad things going on in the world.
If everyone is looking for a hero, they won't have to look far. The Avengers are everywhere. Along with kids and parents, there's now teens, 20-somethings, and working professionals from Beijing to Berlin buying Avengers products. The next two Avengers sequels are already scheduled for release in 2018 and 2019. Disney and Marvel are betting big on the continued global demand for all things Avengers. And I mean all things. Like pint glasses, ice cube trays, coffee mugs, mason jars, hand towels, bath towels, beach towels, swimsuits, swim goggles, water bottles, headphones, snapbacks, beanies, combat boots, creepers, canvas slip-ons, Gillette razors, duvet covers, TV guitar straps, woven tops, knit bottoms, iPhone covers, granola bars, Subway, double, alu melts, laptop cases, leather jackets, lava lamps, lava lamps, lava lamps. In Los Angeles, I'm Ezra Morris for Marketplace.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm going to go see it. I don't know. Music's all right, but anyway. All right, so listen, if you've got a spare, $2 billion and a really big sweet tooth, have I got a deal for you. Hostess, which was sold off in bankruptcy 2 years ago, has been turned around and is said to be ripe for a sale by the private equity folks who bought it. Steve Bertone is a senior editor at Forbes. He writes about the reinvention of Hostess and Twinkies in particular in the latest issue of the magazine. Steve, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. Excited to talk some Twinkie today.
No joke, right? Take me out to Emporia, Kansas, would you?
It's a magical place. In Emporia, Kansas, right off the highway, is where they make a million Twinkies a day.
There's a half of the plant that's kind of old and run down, the old Twinkie, and then there's literally, you go through a door and it's brand spanking new automations, and that is what these new investors have wrought.
Yes, it's like Willy Wonka. There's the rundown part that feels like you're in an abandoned elementary school or something. Then you walk through these doors, there's bright lights and there's all robots and Twinkies marching down the line nonstop.
This guy, Dean Metropolis, he buys Twinkies, he and some partners buy Twinkies out of the Hostess bankruptcy, basically, and they find efficiencies and they work some magic.
It was a great contrarian play. The funny thing with Hostess and Twinkies was that the snack cake business, even when it was in bankruptcy, was still a billion-dollar business a year.
God.
So people were buying these things. And the brand is special. I mean, when Twinkie went out of business, it was national news. People were selling Twinkies and cupcakes on eBay for $10,000 a box. No one paid that, but that was the bid. And suddenly when Twinkie was back, it was a homecoming. It was opening day baseball after 9 months of being off. And Metropolis said that if they had just taken it over without it being off the shelves for months, they would have never had this great jump start that they had.
Give me the very quick backstory on what happened to the Hostess company, because it had been, you know, they were making $1 billion a year, as you say, but there's a whole backstory as to why they went under.
So the old Hostess was extremely inefficient. And don't forget, they used to have the bread business too, Wonder Bread.
Yeah, the bread part of this and the logistics is the amazing part.
Amazing. So they had an old direct-to-store route, which means basically they had 5,000 delivery trucks dropping goods off a couple times a week.
Yeah.
And all the new places like Walmart and dollar stores have a warehouse distribution model where you ship everything to a giant warehouse and then independent delivery people come by and drop it off.
Right.
And Twinkie has the reputation of being the, you know, the cockroach of the food industry.
Right.
The truth is the old Twinkie only lasted 30 days, and that wasn't long enough for a distribution model with warehouses.
Right.
So they did some creative chemistry, and they doubled the longevity. So now Twinkie can last 65 days, and that allows the much more efficient delivery system. And now delivery costs are about 16% of total revenue, down from 36%, which is crushing.
The idea of Twinkies having even longer shelf life is frankly terrifying. But that goes to what this bankruptcy did for Hostess, right? It let Metropolis and the private equity folks strip out the stuff they didn't want and take the good stuff, so to speak, that they knew they could make money on, and that was Twinkies.
Yeah, the beauty of this deal is that the bankruptcy did all of that private equity dirty work that private equity gets the bad rep for. So they didn't have to do any destruction. It was already destroyed, and they got to start from scratch, basically. And they did start from scratch. When they bought the company, all they had was basically five warehouses, the recipes for Twinkies and Hostess and Ding Dongs, and that's it. There was no shelf space. There were no employees. In fact, there wasn't even any sugar or cocoa or flour in the factories. They started literally from scratch.
Did you eat a Twinkie while you were out there in Emporia?
I got to eat it hot off the conveyor belt. It was incredible.
Stephen Bertone, he writes at Forbes on a whole bunch of stuff, including Twinkies. Stephen, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today from the Marketplace desk of Just Because They Can, I guess. The good people over at the pop culture website Vulture counted up how much screen time each of the individual Avengers got in the new movie we were just talking about. Captain America and Iron Man came in 1-2. I guess that makes sense. Black Widow, that's Scarlett Johansson, to those not familiar with the genre, was third. The Hulk was fifth. That's Bruce Banner and the Hulk combined, by the way. And I would just like to say, speaking for Norwegians everywhere, that Thor totally got the short straw, a lousy 14 minutes of screen time in a 2.5-hour movie. Outrageous. I mean, come on, he's got the hammer and everything. How do you not put him on the screen? The Dow up 46 points today, about 0.25%. The NASDAQ up 11 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 gained 6 points, 0.3%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.